Hallo und herzlich willkommen. Hello and welcome to a new episode of History and Politics, the Körber Stiftung's podcast on history and politics, this time again in English. My name is Gabrielle Wojdelko, and as always, this episode deals with the question why and how history shapes the present. But hold on for a second. Today, it's slightly different and really special because we are facing a friendly takeover. I'd like to warmly welcome Katja Heuer and Oliver Moody, who are hosting our new four-part special summer series, The New Germany. Germany after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, after the German Chancellor's proclamation of a Zeitenwende, the dawn of a new era. All the while keeping an eye on history, of course, as you are used to it from our podcast. Welcome, Katja and Oliver. Over to you, and now let's get started.
Welcome to The New Germany, a special series from the Körber Stiftung's History and Politics podcast, where we investigate Germany's past and present to explain the changes that have been unleashed by Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
And make a few inane jokes about Gerhard Schröder along the way. Go on, Katja, tell us a Schröder joke.
I thought you'd never ask. Right, here we go. A pensioner falls over outside Schröder's chancellery. Schröder helps him up and says, "In return for this magnanimous gesture, you have to vote for me next time." The pensioner replies, "I fell on my back, old boy, not on my head."
Magisterial. Anyway, I'm Oliver Moody, a British journalist based in Berlin.
And I'm Katja Heuer, a German historian based in Britain. And in this episode, Gerhard Schröder, who ruled Germany from 1998 to 2005, will play one of the starring roles, because we're going to be talking about energy and, above all, Russian gas.
But first, I think we should start with another Russia-friendly German politician who died almost exactly 100 years ago to this day. Bear with me a moment while we go back to the outbreak of the First World War, when Walter Rathenau, the head of one of Imperial Germany's most august industrial dynasties, had an epiphany.
What was that? That it might be a good idea to deploy some pieces of heavy artillery to Eastern Europe?
Well, yes, but more pertinently for today's purposes, the war was taking a really heavy toll on the German economy, as British naval ships choked off the ports and the manufacturing sector was repeatedly crippled by waves of strikes. And Rathenau persuaded the government to set up what we would now call a Planwirtschaft, a planned economy, with the state seizing control of all raw materials that were judged to be central to the war effort, from coal to cobalt. His blueprint for subjugating the free market to the higher national interest was quite literally revolutionary. Among others, it inspired a Russian Marxist exile called Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov, best known to posterity as Lenin, and Albert Speer, who used Rathenau's ideas to build the armaments industry that powered the Third Reich's war machine.
Well, thanks for that lecture. You almost sounded like a historian there. But what are we doing in 1914? This is supposed to be the new Germany. I hope this wasn't just another excuse for you to extol the virtues of the British Navy.
It's a damn fine Navy. But no, the point is that Rathenau's ideas have suddenly come back into fashion in Germany. Once again, a war in Europe is causing all sorts of problems with the supply of raw materials, and especially with the provision of Russian gas and oil. And once again, the German government is beginning to poke its nose into the workings of the free market in quite an extraordinary way. Last year, Germany bought about 55% of its gas, 45% of its coal, and 35% of its oil from the Russian state. And all of a sudden, this backbone of the German economy is in jeopardy. So the administration, and in particular Robert Habeck, the vice chancellor and energy minister, are trying to execute one of the most remarkable economic about turns in the country's modern history. In a matter of weeks, the government has effectively nationalised a Russian gas company,
drawn up powers to ration the supply of gas to industrial giants,
given the state the ability to determine which power plants should burn what fuel when,
shut down the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline from Russia, begun amassing a strategic national coal reserve, started assembling floating liquefied natural gas terminals in the North Sea.
And Habeck, a Green, has even ordered his officials to look at whether Germany's moribund nuclear power stations could be kept online, which shows you just how serious things have got. A planned economy in the Leninist sense of the word, this surely ain't. But a massive shift towards statism it indisputably is. So I think it's worth talking about how and why Germany got itself into this mess, and how it's trying to get itself out of it. Katja, we go back to the beginning, and can you tell us a little bit about where Germany's addiction to Russian hydrocarbons first came from?
Well, it really started with the very first Chancellor of West Germany, Konrad Adenauer, who wanted to get some, or actually all of the remaining prisoners of war back from Russia. There were still thousands of men trapped there. And so he traveled to Moscow in 1955 to try and establish channels of diplomacy, really. And if some money could be made along the way, all the better. And it turned out pretty quickly that there was a lot of money to be made because of Russia's immense oil and gas fields, which really just needed to be linked to Europe in some way. And that's basically where the West came in and could sort of help Russia, you know, basically buy its oil off it and make it a lot of money, as well as the Western European nations. So Bonn really pretty quickly signed a trade deal, particularly individual companies were then, you know, kind of coming into that, realizing that there was a lot of money to be had. So companies like Mannesmann, Phoenix Rhein-Ruhr, Hirsch, and so on and so forth, they weren't really supposed to, because the US was obviously keen to strangle kind of communist Russia's sources of income. And what Russia really needed was large diameter pipes, quite a specialized sort of product to get pipes into Western Europe. And that's exactly what the US were targeting. So they had the technology, didn't want to sell it to Russia because of its economic situation. But West Germany thought, hey, there's a lot of money to be made here and we need energy. So let's do this. And some of these companies began undermining the trade embargo.
Can you imagine German companies undermining a trade embargo to build pipelines with Russia?
I know, it's unbelievable.
By the way, Katja, do you know why that visit to Moscow of Adenauer's was such a success?
Go on.
The West German delegation were having an absolutely miserable time trying to keep up with the Soviets' vodka drinking. And then eventually, Adenauer called up his doctor in Bonn and asked if there was any remedy that could help him to stave off the effects of the booze. And as a result, the Germans ended up knocking back a tablespoonful of olive oil before each session. And apparently it worked. But we're in grave danger of digressing. Katja, when did this energy diplomacy really start to take off?
Well, I'm glad that that tip is that old, because people were still telling each other this when I went to university. So clearly it is working, or else that urban myth would have been dispelled by now. But back to energy. Yes, I mean, it did really, you know, I said earlier a lot of money was to be made, but that really accelerated in 1965 when they found further huge gas and oil fields in West Siberia. And obviously, you know, West Germany had its eye on that as well. It did help that at the same time you had a kind of more eastern looking government beginning to take shape. So from 1969, you had the first Social Democratic Chancellor, Willy Brandt, in power. And he appointed a man called Egon Bahr as Secretary of State in the Chancellery. And Egon Bahr had really argued since 1963 that a new Eastern policy or a Neue Ostpolitik was in order, meaning closer relationship with the whole of the Eastern Bloc, really, but specifically with East Germany and with Russia, with Soviet Russia. And so the embargo against the exports of large diameter pipes was lifted at the same time, and that really worked together. So the kind of acceleration of closer working relationships between West Germany and Soviet Russia could really kick off. And so accordingly, in 1970, you get a huge deal signed between Ruhrgas and Mannesmann and Deutsche Bank together with the Russians. And the idea was basically that they would deliver 1.2 million tons of pipage over and 1.2 billion Deutschmarks as a loan. And at the same time, the Soviets would return 2.5 billion marks worth of gas to West Germany. And that really kicked off this sort of huge you know, trade that you see later, and that we still see the ramifications of today. You then had direct pipeline projects being conceived, such as Megal, for instance, in 1975, and also the Trans-Siberian pipeline in 1981. So this idea of sort of Russian gas being delivered to Germany wasn't just happening in East Germany, but also in West Germany pretty swiftly. But after the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, the Germans kept buying ever more fossil fuels from the Russians. And this is the point, of course, where our favourite German Don Quixote ends the story.
Gerhard Schröder, the Gerd himself. We've already talked quite a bit about his bromance with Vladimir Putin in the second episode of this series on German-Russian relations. And if you haven't listened to that, don't worry. We're not the type of people to hold a grudge.
Well, I am.
Katya is, but all will be forgiven. Schröder is an important figure in this story for two reasons. The first is his Energiewende, the energy turn to a supposedly cleaner and brighter future. Solar panels on 100,000 roofs, an eco-tax on electricity, the end of Germany's nuclear power sector, and all of it underpinned by masses and masses of lovely, cheap Russian gas, the supposedly transitional fuel that would set his country on the path to this future. And this is the second reason why Schröder matters. One of his final acts as Chancellor was to usher in the Nord Stream pipeline along the bottom of the Baltic Sea, the first direct gas connection between Germany and Russia. Katya, why was this such a big deal?
Well, the entanglement with Schröder, as you say, was there quite early on. I mean, the first feasibility studies to see if it was possible to have a direct gas pipeline from Russia to northern Germany across the Baltic Sea happened in 1998, which was also the same year that Schröder came into power as German Chancellor. And then once that was all done, basically, he was involved with this process all the way through and the agreement was signed. The timing is really rather interesting. You've got basically on the 8th of September 2005, the agreement is signed, and that's 10 days before the election that was going to oust Gerhard Schröder. So
that's a shocking coincidence.
I know. It really is quite remarkable. But it was interesting as well because all of the polls had already shown that Schröder was most likely to lose the election. And so he actually left the campaign trail 10 days before the election to sign this agreement off together with Gazprom, BASF and E.ON. So, you know, that was obviously interesting timing there, and also interesting timing that he joined the board of Gazprom and later Rosneft shortly after he ceased to be the German Chancellor as well. This was then officially inaugurated, this Nord Stream 1 pipeline, by Angela Merkel's government in 2011. Lots of the European greats present as well. So you've got the Russian President Medvedev, the French Prime Minister present as well, and the Dutch Prime Minister, and then so on and so forth. So this isn't exclusively a German project, I would like to highlight, but nonetheless, obviously, it was initiated from Gerhard Schröder's government and then inaugurated by Angela Merkel's. And then it was realized, obviously, that a lot of, again, money is to be made here. It's a huge capacity that's of gas that's going through this. And so in 2011, they started looking into doubling the capacity effectively by building a parallel pipeline, which was later renamed into Nord Stream 2. An interesting character as well in all of this is a man called Matthias Warnig, who used to be a Stasi officer turned banker, who really straight after the Berlin Wall fell, went over to Russia and then, you know, since has had his fingers in all sorts of Russian pies. And for instance, he became the CEO of the Nord Stream company from 2006 to 2015. And then the CEO of Nord Stream 2 is also involved in aluminium and all sorts of other Russian raw materials. And Schröder is now the chairman of the board of the Nord Stream 2 AG. So it's an interesting combination of German industrialists and politicians, not least the former Chancellor Gerhard Schröder involved in this.
And I think the really interesting juncture in this part of the story is 2015. So it's the year after Russia has annexed Crimea and stirred up a war in Donbass, and Germany is taking a lead in trying to broker a ceasefire through what became known as the Minsk Accords. But at the same time, it not only approves the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, but also, one, it sells a bunch of gas turbines that get installed in Crimea. Two, it lets a Russian state energy company acquire a controlling stake in its largest oil refinery, PCK at Schwedt. Three, it flogs off its biggest gas storage facility, Rheden, to Gazprom. And four, it obviously conspicuously fails to build any infrastructure to support LNG imports during the US shale boom. How is that possible?
Yeah, you're asking me. Ask Gerhard Schröder. No, there's it's the timing again is particularly interesting here. And as you say, 2015 is perhaps a prime example. In January of that year, Gazprom announced that the expansion of the project had to be put on hold because of sanctions effectively following the annexation of Crimea. But in June, so 6 months later, an agreement to build Nord Stream 2 was signed between Gazprom and European energy companies. So somehow they've managed, obviously, to get over the shock of that very quickly and to see if money could be made again. It's interesting as well that this was done in the face of huge US opposition. So in 2019, famously under Donald Trump still as president, the US actually threatened sanctions against Germany and the other stakeholders of this project because they saw it as a serious kind of geopolitical problem, as it turned out rightly. Nonetheless, the laying of the second line was completed in September 2021, and basically now in front of a fait accompli, Joe Biden and Angela Merkel tried to come to some sort of arrangement what they're going to do with this finished project now. And the deal was that if Russia uses Nord Stream 2 as a political weapon, and basically cutting off Poland and Ukraine from Russian gas supplies, then Ukraine basically needs to be supported. So they did actually get a $50 million loan, basically dollar loan for green technology, but also Germany would then have to respond to that and basically deal with Russia on a political basis. That they would use it as a weapon turned out pretty quickly, even before the actual war in Ukraine started. So in November 2021, European gas prices shot up by 17%. Because Germany's energy regulator had suspended the approval of Nord Stream 2, so that this was going to be weaponized became obvious relatively early on. And then Scholz, of course, had to suspend Nord Stream 2 on the 22nd of February 2022 as a consequence of Russia's recognition of Donetsk and Luhansk in the build-up to the war.
Well, our expert guest is about to come in and bring us up to the present, but I do have one final question for you, which is this. The Nord Stream 2 pipeline has obviously been built, and it's sitting there full of gas, but it's hard to imagine it delivering any of the stuff to Germany anytime soon. So what do you think we should do with it?
Well, I hope you're right and they're not just going to resurrect it at the first opportunity. But if they don't, I quite like the idea of a Munich architect who's suggested that a kind of water palace could be built with the pipes. So you just sort of stack them up on top of each other, cut into smaller chunks, and create this sort of amazing water palace, which would be an altogether more delightful way of using them. What would you do with it?
I like your water palace, but if you look at the dimensions of the pipeline, it's got an internal diameter of 45 inches, just under 4 feet. So I reckon if you crouch down in the fetal position and install some clever pneumatics, it should be entirely possible to send German social democratic politicians of a certain vintage whizzing along the pipeline at considerable speeds to their board meetings in St. Petersburg. It's cheap, it's green, it's discreet. You don't have to worry about your pesky Eastern European neighbours closing off their airspace or railways to Russia. I think it's time for the Schröder tube.
Excellent idea. I'm sure that's going to be well received.
Put Germany's current energy headaches into their proper historical context, we're joined by Helen Thompson, Professor of Political Economy at the University of Cambridge. Helen is one of Britain's foremost experts on how energy shapes the world's politics. She may be familiar to hardcore podcast enthusiasts from her many appearances on the excellent Talking Politics series. More pertinently for today's purposes, she recently published a book called Disorder. I hope I'm not butchering the subject matter if I describe it as a history of the interlocking crises of the present and the underlying forces that have driven them, in particular, energy, international finance, and the politics of the nation state. Helen, welcome to the New Germany podcast. We're delighted to have you on.
And I'm delighted to be here.
Helen, at the start of your book, you pick out the 1956 Suez Crisis as a pivotal moment in modern Europe's energy story. What happened and how did it drive successive West German governments into the arms of Moscow?
Okay, there's a lot in that question. let's start with a sort of immediate post-war years, because I think that they're the context for the Suez crisis, at least for the implications of the Suez crisis on the energy side. And the essential problem that West European countries faced energy-wise, which really was predominantly oil-wise, because a country like Germany and Britain were fine where coal supplies were concerned, is that the United States didn't want European countries to go back to importing oil from the Western Hemisphere, including from the United States itself. And neither, once the Cold War began, did they want them importing oil from the Soviet Union, though it would be said that the Soviet Union's capacity for exports after the war was not really there. So that meant importing oil from the Middle East. And obviously the Middle East was a quite geopolitically complex place, and it was not one where the United States wanted to expend its power in providing energy security for its West European allies. So primary responsibility for providing security for West European oil imports was essentially within the West, so to speak, given to Britain and Britain's ongoing imperial presence in the Middle East. So from the point of view of West European governments, when the British, supported by the French and the Israelis, acted in the way which they did after the Suez Canal Company was nationalised, they were doing what they were supposed to do. In particular, Britain was doing what it was supposed to do, which was to act as a guarantor of Western European energy security in the Middle East. But the timing, in part, of the crisis and Eisenhower's willingness to try to accommodate Arab nationalism meant that Eisenhower reacted to the British and French Israeli intervention with fury, and essentially used the financial power that the United States had against Britain to terminate that operation. And that was met with fury, not only in London and Paris, but in Bonn too. Adenauer regarded it as a betrayal of European reason of state. That was the language that he used. It showed to him that the Americans were utterly unreliable when it came to Western European interests. And it's in the context of that that West European governments, and which West Germany was certainly at the forefront initially anyway, made a turn to Soviet oil. Now, it should be said that this is a turn back. It's not that the energy relationship between Western Europe and the Soviet Union, or West Germany in the Soviet Union, began at this point. It had existed in the interwar years, the late 1920s through the middle of the, well, really through the 1930s. And so it was a bid to return to something that had been made taboo by the Cold War. It wasn't the only response that West European countries had to the Suez Crisis in energy terms. In France and in Britain, it was part of the reason for the push for nuclear power. And I think it's fair to say, in France, there was the view that Algerian oil was going to be the solution to the problem. Algerian oil having been discovered in 1956, the same year as the Suez Crisis. And the French were very keen that Algeria would be part of the European economic community, and then that in some sense Western Europe would be bound in by a unified market into buying Algerian oil. Now, that didn't really work out because of the fact that Algeria would, you know, win its fight for independence. So I'd say the lasting energy legacy of the Suez Crisis became the turn back to Soviet oil. I mean, there's a kind of supplement to the story that comes, we can get to that.
And when did this become, in West Germany's case, about gas?
It really becomes about gas in the 1960s, particularly the latter part of the 1960s, and that is both because gas starts to become a much more significant energy source. It's not really important in the 1950s. It's also the case that in the latter part of the 1960s, that the Soviets basically discover the West Siberian fields that include oil and gas, vast fields that include oil and gas. And as we know, by the time that this is happening, then the Christian Democrats are no longer in power in Bonn, and the Social Democrats under Willy Brandt have got bigger ideas anyway of reconfiguring the relationship between West Germany and the Soviet Union. And then it becomes in the 70s when the gas pipelines start to be built running through into the early 80s.
And even after Germany was reunified in 1990 and the Soviet Union broke up the following year, this dependency on Russian gas continued to deepen to the point where it reached 55% of Germany's gas imports last year. Was that primarily because the gas was cheap and Germany didn't really have much of an incentive to spend lots of money on things like expensive infrastructure for importing liquefied natural gas from other sources? Or to what extent were political considerations involved as well?
I think that there's lots of different things actually going on in the post-1990s relationship, also the post-1991 relationship. I think part of it is where gas is concerned, that, as you say, Oliver, that it's cheap, it was established, there were long contracts in place, it was a reliable as well as a cheap source of gas, and that actually disrupting the entire gas infrastructure for something that wasn't clear what the alternatives were. And I mean by that in the 1990s, I don't think it needs too much explanation to understand like why that status quo remained in place. I think it's also true in the 1990s that the German energy companies realized that they had an opportunity to establish some presence themselves in what was now Russia, i.e. that what had been Soviet oil and gas was no longer going to be controlled by this something like the Soviet Energy Ministry, that there was an opportunity, there were commercial opportunities for Western companies in Russia. And whilst the big oil majors, of which there is no German big oil major, took their chances on the oil side, it was the German companies that took their chances more on the gas side, or at least had a chance on the gas side, including in some of the later agreements actually having some production rights in Western Siberia. I think if you then say, when does the geopolitics around this change? It starts to change when liquid natural gas imports becomes a growing sector, which is in the 2000s. Now, at that point, it doesn't obviously include the United States. So the United States doesn't join the worldwide market. It's not actually a worldwide market, but it doesn't. The United States doesn't acquire a gas export capacity until the 2010s. So I would say, is there a counterfactual where Germany could have realistically, plausibly done something different, and we then need an explanation of why it didn't? I think we're moving really into the 2010s and the American shale revolution, and the fact that the United States is, or American producers, I should say, are in a position to compete with Russia in the European markets. And Germany is the European country that is really just steadfastly opposed to that, to the point, as we know, where no liquid natural gas ports were built either in the 2000s or in the when you start getting, you know, Qatar becoming a significant exporter, or in the 2010s when the United States has become a significant exporter. So I think the real question in terms of where was the point in which there were alternatives, where was there a path not taken? I think the answer is in the 2010s, not earlier.
And where does Nord Stream 2 specifically fit into that? So, I mean, it's easy to see that, you know, Russia gains political leverage, increased revenue, decreased reliance on Ukraine. But what did Berlin get out of it, given that it already had adequate supplies through its existing pipelines?
Well, I think here we've got to go back to Nord Stream 1, actually. In some sense, I think that's more revealing of like the underlying dynamics. And then Merkel's Nord Stream 2 decision, I think, has to be sort of seen in the context of the post-Crimea situation. So if we go back to Nord Stream 1, there had initially been interest in building a pipeline that would utilise the Baltic Sea for what was supposed to be Russia's new projects in the Arctic. And this had evolved Finland as a partner. And it attracted interest from a number of European countries in terms of what would happen after the gas had come from the Arctic into the Baltic and where at sea and where it might then move on, including, it must be said, from the British government and when Tony Blair was Prime Minister. So what became the Nord Stream pipeline didn't begin as a move to try to cut Ukraine out of the transit system. It was supposed to connect to new gas projects for Russia. What I think then changed was the situation in Ukraine in the aftermath of the Orange Revolution. So the events of late 2004, early 2005, that led to Yushchenko becoming president in January of 2005. And obviously, with that development, relations between Ukraine and Russia became much more tense. I mean, they'd been quite tense in a number of ways before, but they took on another level of tension. And given that energy had been central to the instabilities in the Ukraine-Russia relationship, both in relation to managing the pipelines, I should say, plural, and in relation to Ukraine's own imports of energy from Russia, there was a sense, I think it's fair to say, shared in Moscow, in Berlin, and among the German industrial companies, that now transit through Ukraine was a risk and that they wanted a way out of that. On the Moscow, on the Russian side, obviously, because in part they wanted to punish Ukraine, they wanted to find ways of using the transit issues and the pricing issues to Ukraine as a way of pressurizing a Ukraine that was bidding to move away from Russia. And on the German side, both at the government level and at the business level, the sense that actually Germany's energy security was now vulnerable to conflict between Russia and Ukraine. And that played out. I mean, in that sense, I think that you could say that the German position was vindicated in its own terms by the fact that there was a big dispute between Russia and Ukraine in January 2006 and then again in January 2009. Now, in neither instance did supply to Germany actually get affected. In January 2009 was the worst of the two incidents or crises, and it was Bulgaria that really got hit very badly by what happened in terms of supplies being cut off that were coming through the Ukrainian pipelines. So I think that the German position from 2005 onwards, before we get to the Crimean crisis, essentially was that Ukraine was an unreliable transit state for Germany and that Germany was simply doing what was in its interests by having a pipeline that directly took gas from Russia to Germany and bypassing Ukraine. And the fact that that had then geopolitical implications for Ukraine's independence, the fact that it was very much opposed by the Polish government and the Baltic states, was, I think, neither here nor there on the grounds that Germany's energy security came first. So I don't think it was simply a case of, say, I don't think it's fair to say that the Germans had no reason to worry about energy security in relation to Ukraine. I think the critique would be that the German government and German companies acted as if that was the only consideration in play at that time. And that when the Ukrainians and the Polish government said, look, there's more to this, much more to this than whether you have energy security or not, they didn't want to hear that.
If I can briefly interject, just because we're going to get cut off at 5:30, and I'd really like to get on to the questions about the energy transition. And you've just, I think, effectively answered what was going to be the question about reliability and the signs that the gas supply was actually loaded with geopolitical connotations.
So what does the war in Ukraine actually mean for Germany's attempts to shift towards greener energy? I mean, Germany has had to burn more coal, will probably have to burn more coal. There's also the view that obviously it'll have to build new fossil infrastructure in the shape of LNG terminals. There's also long-term gas deals with Qatar and the US. So what does this all mean for the future of German energy?
Well, I think it's a moment of clarity on the energy transition, because aside from anything else, it just shows how difficult the energy transition is that once you have, you know, disruptions of the kind that the war has brought about to the supply and cost of fossil fuel energy, everybody in Europe is being confronted with how deeply dependent Western economies and Western way of life is on fossil fuel energy. I think the really interesting question for Germany in particular, and I think you can see this playing out already in its pursuit of liquid natural gas deals, is it really brings to a head a timing question around gas. And in some sense, more than a timing question, I mean, is gas supposed to be a bridge energy source because it emits less carbon than other fossil fuels? Or is gas as much part of the problem as coal and oil, and needs to be got rid of as quickly as possible? And I think one of the interesting things that happened in the sort of from the mid, somewhere in the latter part of the 2010s, was the view that gas was a bridge energy source kind of fell away, and gas just got lumped with everything else. And I think that that was true in Germany too. But that now that notion is acting as a constraint on how Germany can adapt to the war. Because if you're Qatar, you want to give contracts that are of at least 20 years, if not more. And the German government doesn't want contracts that go into the 2040s, because it's working on the assumption that it will be out of gas, needing gas by then. But it's clear that no long-term contract has actually been signed with Qatar. There's various sort of commitments about, short-term commitments about a bit of gas coming from its American plant from 2024, and further talks about long-term cooperation. But there is no, as I can see, there's no contract as yet being signed. And that puts Germany in a rather different position than, say, China, which is busily been signing quite a number of long-term contracts with American liquid natural gas. And firms are not only American ones, but notably American ones over the last 18 months or so. So I think that Germany's in a position where some really kind of quite painful, difficult choices have now got to be made. It's a moment of like reckoning, in the sense of, what does the German government really think about the speed of the energy transition? Is it at all plausible that there won't be significant need for gas by 2040?
I suppose the most straightforward way to get off gas is just to use less of it. Mm. And there's a fascinating political experiment underway in Germany right now, where the government is just starting a mass advertising campaign precisely to try and persuade households and businesses to consume less gas for things like heating. And I'm really interested to hear your perspective on whether these sort of appeals for self-sacrifice might work in the current context, and whether history has anything useful to tell us about it.
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting question. I think if you look at the one politician in the West who most try to run with a energy sacrifice position is Jimmy Carter, and he tried to, in some sense, turn it into a moral project to rejuvenate the United States' sense of collective purpose. And as we know, things turned out quite disastrously for Carter. I mean, it's not the only explanation for Carter's woes and the fact that he lost the presidency to Ronald Reagan, but it's a pretty significant part of it. So I think that we'd be pretty hard pushed to find an example of successful Western party or politician who really could make appeals to reducing energy consumption work politically. I think it is really noticeable, though, that across Europe, not just in Germany, but interestingly in Italy too, that appeals are being made to such sacrifices in the name of resisting Russia. And this does, I think, change the context in which such appeals have been made. Before, when Carter was doing it, he was having a foreign policy dimension to it, in the sense of, we need not to be dependent upon that turbulent place, the Middle East. And he was also talking about resource constraints and resource depletion. But there wasn't, in some sense, an external enemy that could quite be rallied around, at least in a moral way. I mean, I suppose there's something of that in what he was saying about the Middle East, but I don't think it's as clear a cut case as it is with the war, of saying, look, if we want to defeat Putin's tyranny and appalling war of aggression against Ukraine, we need to give something up. So I think it's possible that this is more palatable politically than Carter's attempt at doing this was. Having said that, I think the test is like what happens during the winter and what happens if there is no real improvement in Ukraine's military position from what's gone on in the last, say, 6 weeks or so, so that the appeals for sacrifices of energy consumption in the name of supporting Ukraine look futile. And I think the politics of that are not likely to work.
If you'd like to find out more about how Germany and the wider West got into this mess, I'd wholeheartedly recommend buying Helen's book, Disorder, which also has a lot of interesting things to say about Germany's place in Europe and its handling of the 2010 Eurozone crash, among many other subjects. Helen, thank you very much indeed for talking to the New Germany podcast.
It's a pleasure to talk to you both.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The New Germany, the first English language series from the Körber Stiftung's History and Politics podcast. We will be back in a fortnight to discuss how memories of the First and Second World War have shaped Germany's response to the Ukraine crisis and why Olaf Scholz keeps telling us that he isn't Kaiser Wilhelm II. Other episodes from this podcast, including the Körber Stiftung's own experts, are available on pretty much any platform where podcasts can be obtained. You can also visit the Körber Stiftung's website, körber-stiftung.de, for more information. If for some reason you've enjoyed the experience, do feel free to leave a review or tweet at us at Hoyer_cat, at Oliver N. Moody, and at Körber History.
And if you haven't enjoyed it, you're also welcome to express your displeasure on the same channels where it will be constructively received. Probably. Auf Wiederhören from Berlin.
And Godspeed from Sussex. Tschüss!